extra time.
Hello and welcome back to the Extra Time podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and this week I'm joined by Henry Hill. Hello, Henry. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. Just rolling on. You know, I feel like my life has just deteriorated into looking at houseplants and other themes to improve my house living. I feel like this weekend was a particular low point of just searching the web for Christmas trees. Can we start again? Because I've bored myself with that conversation.
No, I think this should all stay in. I think people love this. No. I spent the weekend looking for new light fixtures because we've had a lot of like stand-in ones like around the house, and they look like garbage, and my wife and I are both miserable now, and we're trying to buy plants as well, but then I'm trying to figure out which plants won't kill my cat. You know, it's a nightmare.
See, it's difficult. All life is at the moment is choosing which park you're going to walk in and what house plant you're going to improve your bedroom with, and that's the key to getting by. That's my top tip.
Well, I mean, the fact you have an option of parks alone. I mean, I have one, but it's Richmond Park, so that's pretty good.
It's not too bad. It's packed. I can tell you that much for nothing. It is packed. But anyway, the good thing is there's been a ton of football on, which you know, for fans across the world, I'm sure keep their weekends busy at the moment.
Yeah, but I can't decide what's sadder. That, like, last week I was sad that it was an international break and there was no football to watch. Or this week I was like, I'd been excited about watching the football, even though I sort of assumed Arsenal were going to lose to Leeds going into the weekend. So I was like, what was I looking forward to with this weekend? And then I think what I was looking forward to is just not scrolling through Netflix looking for something tolerable to watch.
I agree with you. I mean, I got way too excited by the prospect of Fulham on the BBC. I think even Gary Lineker, he was like, "Welcome back to the best game in the Premier League." I was like, "Fulham Everton, it's not." I mean, he must like, considering all the fine work he does in the Champions League, he must be thinking, "What on earth has happened that I'm paneling Fulham versus Everton?" Which did actually turn out to be quite a good game in the end, I must say. I just want to raise this with you. So you're an Arsenal fan. But I feel like if you're within the Football Daily WhatsApp chat, or I feel like there's some weird pressure to support a big team. It's like, I support Fulham and I know they're rubbish, but you don't need to keep reminding me that they're rubbish all the time. Do you know what I mean? It's like, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to just to support Chelsea just to join in the general kind of, "Oh, my team's doing well" conversation? Do you know what I mean? It's always, Fulham in the mud again. Fulham are crap. Fulham are this. It's like, well, yeah, I do expect that because I support Fulham. I'm not like unaware of the situation.
I don't understand that either. Like people will say like, "Oh, Arsenal are shit," and I'm like, "Yeah, we are shit. So what?" And then it's like 1-0. Like, it's just no. You can't hurt me by pointing out that Arsenal are shit. Like, that is how it's been for 10 years. I'm used to it now. You know, like with you and Doogie, who support, like, I don't know, I suppose smaller clubs overall, it's way less tragic than it is when somebody supports a small club but thinks it's a big club, like, for instance, Celtic. and they get like really defensive about it, and you're like, it's honestly just football, and none of us chose these teams. Like, all of us accidentally ended up supporting them, and it's awful.
I chose Fulham because my parents hate football, and Fulham was the only team my dad would ever even consider going towards. He was like, "There's a neutral end. That's a pretty good reason." He was like, if my wife is going to make me have to spend time with my son, which, believe me, he doesn't enjoy, then I'm going to go to the nearest possible stadium in the nicest location, and I'm just going to endure it for 90 minutes. I mean, I remember I took my parents to see it was a nice summer's evening. We went to see Fulham versus Middlesbrough in the...
What a treat. Like,
I know. I mean, I really sold it to them. But it was in the League Cup, and it was like 0-0 after 90 minutes, and we were sat in the wooden stand, which is like, it's really nice, but it is uncomfy across 90 minutes, and it finished 0-0, and they both stood up and like, "Right, it's time to go." I was like, "Absolutely not. We've got half an hour more of this absolute thriller. we're not going anywhere until Darren Bent has finished this game off for good," because that was the time it was. And I remember their look of like, "What? We're never doing this again." And sure enough, I've never managed to coax them back to Craven Cottage, which is a shame because it is one of the great all-time stadiums. But yeah, I am just a bit bereft of people just reminding me that Fulham are rubbish. I'm like, I don't know what you expect. They're not going to win the league. Well, I mean, well, they're not going to win the league. I'm going to say that now. And if that bites me, if I'm proven wrong in years come by, then great. But yeah, it's just a funny kind of scenario that we're in at Football Daily.
I mean, it is nice though when your family aren't into football. It's kind of great that I just never ever have to talk about football with my family. Like my wife's family don't care. My family certainly don't care. I mean, like, it's kind of amazing that your parents went to a football game with you. Because if I said to my parents, come to a football match with me, they'd just be like, no, like absolutely not. I only support Arsenal because when I was a kid, like when I was like 5 or 6 and like really getting into football, somehow all the adults I knew were Arsenal fans, like who were into football were Arsenal fans. And so I was like, well, I guess I support Arsenal then.
Yeah.
My dad was my mum will watch a bit of the World Cup, whereas my dad is like, will go out of his way to avoid that.
Yeah, I think I like with work, they always go, how's work going? I'm like, yeah, it's fine. You're appearing in more things. Oh, yeah. And I'm presenting a bit more. That I'm like, do you want to see? They're like, no, it's fine. We don't want to watch that. No. We trust that you're having a good time. I'm like, sure, why not? And we're a better place to be than the podcast. It's been a while, so it's nice to be back on.
Yeah, well, we've kind of we haven't really had a chance to do it because obviously you and I both ignore the Football Daily group chat as much as possible, as hinted at in this conversation, and therefore we haven't been able to get together to sort one out. But this week, obviously, there was an enormous result. Tottenham Hotspur beating Man City 2-0 at, what is their say? Is it just called White Hart Lane, or are we calling it White Hart Lane?
It's not. I think it's just called the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, to the point.
Rubbish. Anyway, yeah, goals from Heung-min Son and Giovanni Lo Celso gave Spurs a pretty impressive win overall to put them top of the table. Now, afterwards, people were saying this was a bit of a Mourinho masterclass, and I couldn't decide whether that meant that they thought Mourinho had done a great job or whether they thought Mourinho had got a bit lucky. And from my point of view, I thought both things were a little bit true. Like, City massively outshot Spurs. I think it was like 22 shots to 4. Gabriel Jesus obviously had a goal ruled out, which I saw 100 replays, but all of the same angle, and I still don't really know if it was a handball or not, but I don't really care. But City were restricted to low quality attempts, so it kind of felt like Spurs both did a good job at stopping City getting big chances, but when you look at how many small chances City had, Spurs were a little bit lucky that not a single one of them ended up in the goal. That was my take on it. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with the masterclass thing. Although, I mean, I think we're overlooking.
You
the
love
fact
Mourinho.
That I do. I think he's just cool. He's a cult figure, isn't he? And I mean, when I was saying this to you before, I really do feel like the way his managerial career went at Man United is going to be reevaluated. Like, I feel as if people do forget that he did win trophies there. He has technically won trophies wherever he's been, I think. If we just take a nostalgic look, I think what he achieved with Porto was incredible, to think that a Portuguese team actually won the Champions League. I think what he did with Inter Milan was amazing. I'll never forget that Barcelona game where he ran out on the pitch at the end, sort of giving it the double-barreled salute. And he's, I almost felt weirdly like emotional watching him get battered down in recent years and you know, buying into the concept that his football is a bit outdated and stuff like that. And, you know, as you said here, four shots to, was it 22, 24? So they really did sort of dig in their heels. But I think like with this game in particular, you have to accept that Man City just weren't. I mean, it's not like a masterclass to have a look at Man City's attack and say, wait a minute, there is a way to stifle this. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, with Ferran Torres, Gabriel Jesus, who I personally am not swayed as a world class striker, if that makes sense. You know, not in the grain of Aguero. And I think when you've got players like Højbjerg who are playing at the top of their game at the moment, I mean, Højbjerg and Serge Aurier this week put in 5 tackles each, which is a joint match high. When you've got players like that who really know what they're doing, and I actually think it's nice to see Eric Dier reinvent himself as a pretty solid centre-back, sort of no nonsense, which I think Mourinho quite likes in many regards. He's played so well recently. You know, and even, you know, Sissoko is an absolute workhorse as well. I don't think it's not so much a masterclass, but it's just, they just got outperformed by a more defensively astute team, if that makes sense at all. But at the same time, you know, Tottenham are performing really well at the moment. They've conceded the fewest. No Premier League team has conceded fewer than Spurs at 9 at the moment. And actually, only Chelsea have outscored them as well. So this idea, yes, we can say that it was a defensive masterclass, but their defence is running so hot at the moment. As you know, we've talked about Harry Kane and Heung-Min Son quite a lot. I'm sure you have in previous weeks and stuff like that. Obviously, they're incredible. And the difference, I thought, in the game is when Tottenham broke forwards, they looked like they might score. They looked like something dangerous could happen. But when City went the other way, there was just this kind of impending sense of failure that was their attack was going to break down at some points. And they weren't quite able to cut through. And, you know, I like Mahrez. I think Mahrez is a really good player. But I think he was slightly stifled against this Tottenham defence, who were more than prepared for what he was going to bring to the table.
And I think City do this thing, like, I don't quite know why it is, but like, just gradually over the last 3 years, like, it's kind of been a joke, but they just cross a lot.
Yeah.
They cross so much, and they cross so much for such a small team. Like, I do not understand it. Like, you've got, you know, De Bruyne, whose delivery is incredible. And to be fair, their disallowed goal came from a cross that kind of took a nick and then ended up on the knee of / arm of Gabriel Jesus. But it seems so strange that they go into these games and the assumption is always, well, what we'll get is like Kevin De Bruyne just whipping balls into the box as opposed to picking their way through. And I don't know if maybe there is some truth there in this idea that losing David Silva has been a problem for them when it comes to those like neat combinations around the edge of the box. But there's a part of me, you know, a couple of people I saw talking on Twitter after the game were saying, given how well he's doing this season, given all his statistics and his age, and kind of the way that Pep seems to want to play, City should maybe think about signing like Dominic Calvert-Lewin like next summer.
Yeah.
And there was just a part of me that was like, no, come on. And then the more I thought about it, I was like, but that is how they want to play. Like, they do want a guy who's really dominant in the air. And it's not like Calvert-Lewin's useless with his feet. Like, they just need this presence. And when you go up against Spurs, it seems so ill-advised. Like, Spurs are the fourth tallest team in the Premier League. I was actually digging into this. I spent ages going into it. Because I started writing a script about Harry Kane the other day before discovering we'd done exactly the same script a week earlier. but I looked at the 25 first-team regulars in the Spurs squad, and only 8 of them are under 6 feet tall. And 6 of the 8 signings they've made since Mourinho joined are over 6 foot. Yeah, and I thought, yeah, this is some Mourinho sh-. but Pep should kind of know stuff like this going into a match like this. And then when you're whipping balls into the box, like, what's your hope that Rodri's going to come in and get a header? I mean, the one thing I will say about Pep is he obviously has decided to dial up the press again recently. Like, the press has been gradually getting weaker, I think. But in this match, every 6.5 passes that Spurs completed, City were attempting a tackle, which is about the highest rate in the Prem. Like, that's kind of Leeds level, who are the highest pressing side in the Prem. Whereas Spurs only attempted a tackle every 15 City passes. Okay. But they had that system, didn't they, where when the ball was going out wide, Sissoko or Højbjerg would drop in next to the fullback to give them an extra man. And so many times, whoever it was in the middle, whether it was Rodri, whether it was De Bruyne, would try and swing the ball out to the wing, and just Reguilon or Aurier would be able to pick it off. And like you said, every time Spurs got the ball, it felt like 2-3 passes and they were away.
It's true. I mean, the thing about Spurs, as like you said there, they just clearly were just biding their time, waiting for the right moment to attack. And I think, you know, often City look for other teams to overcommit to them in terms of going flying in for the tackle and then making that moment just to work their way around them. So clearly Mourinho just, you know, 10 players behind the ball, apparently the heat map in the first half had a lot of the Spurs players inside their own half. But yeah, clearly, you know, there's a really like intelligent structure to that. So they, you know, they knew exactly what they're doing. And it's not as if they do this all the time. I mean, if we consider that Spurs, no team in the league has made more pressures than Spurs this season. And the majority of those pressures are coming in their own defensive third. I mean, I love like Sergio Reguilón. I think he's really contributed that kind of energy down the left flank, which they were maybe missing. And I like Ben Davies. I think he's a solid addition to the squad. And I think he's really useful in the sense that he can actually drop into centre-back as well if needed and play in a back three or another five. But Reguilón is quite clearly, you know, he's ranked up his... he's really ranked up that left side of the defence. But, you know, Mourinho's teams, they still make the fourth most fouls in the league and play a very low block, with only two teams catching opponents offside less often. So, I do like the way that Mourinho did clearly adapt for this game, but it isn't a masterclass. I just, like you said, I just think Manchester City really just struggled to figure out how to unpick this defence. And in regards to your Calvert-Lewin comment, you know, I think they're going to be well in for the... When Erling Haaland is made available by Borussia Dortmund, surely Manchester City have got to look at that and think, if we're willing to spend £100 million on new centre-backs, which, let's face it, they did need new centre-backs, and they are more defensively astute with Ruben Dias certainly at the back line next to Aymeric Laporte, which in principle is the makings of an incredible centre-back partnership. But that hasn't really changed their ability going forward much. Obviously, I think Ferran Torres could go on to be maybe one of the signings... off the century. I'm not even being funny about that. You know, for 20 million for someone of his ability, he has all the hallmarks of someone who really could go on to achieve something. But, you know, that doesn't... Signing £100 million worth of defenders doesn't really make up for the fact that without Aguero, who's missed so many games over the past few seasons... And, you know, I do think losing David Silva has been a loss. I think you only have to see the way that Sociedad have kicked on with his addition. I just struggle to see how City are going to manage to take down a team as physical... as Tottenham, who I just think just really, without being too clever about it, just completely outdid City in this pretty technical battle.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's broadly true. I think there's a lot of work for City to do, but I also think that this Spurs side is not as good as it's currently being claimed to be.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, I think Mourinho's doing an okay job, but I'm reluctant to give him huge credit for it, because I also think that I'd rather give credit to the transfer work, because I think they went out and just filled all their holes this summer. And I think really the most important thing to me is just to fit Kane. Like, Kane is running super hot right now. Like, Kane has got 16 goals and assists. XG says he should have about 11, which would be ridiculous enough. But 16 goals and assists after, what is it, 9 games is genuinely outrageous. But the thing is, Mourinho actually was kind of part of the problem in preventing Kane getting fully fit. You know, like Mourinho was saying back in, you know, a couple of months ago, he was saying, look, when players say they're fit, you know, they know better than any doctor. They know better than any physio. I think he was saying that about Son. And I was like, that's not true, Jose. It's not. And the fact that you believe that is really, really troubling. And it's very, very clear that having an enforced break for Harry Kane has really made the difference. You know, and there was a bit later on in this game, you know, when he got the ball on the wing and he just went absolutely flying down the wing.
Yes.
And I just thought, there's no way Harry Kane would have done this before. Like, I'd looked this up previously. And between 2017 and when the Premier League was halted because of coronavirus in April... Kane's three longest periods without playing a game were 61 days, 28 days, and 62 days. Those were his three biggest rests during that time, which, given that he had a couple of ligament injuries, an ankle injury, a knee injury, like loads of injuries in that time, it's kind of crazy that his longest break was 2 months. But the fact that because he got injured on New Year's Day of 2020, and then there was the COVID break, when he returned in Project Restart, he'd gone 170 days without playing. He'd gone nearly 6 months without playing a game. And he'd finally fully recovered. You know, like, his numbers after lockdown weren't, like, way, way better. They weren't as good as they were this season. But he obviously just had time to, like, get back this fitness. And now this season as well, I also think that you can kind of... You know, you were talking before about Mourinho's Real Madrid side, his Inter Milan side, his Porto side. And I think that actually now you can see the way Kane is playing is quite similar to the way he used strikers in those sides. Like, you think of Diego Costa, you know, like scoring goals for him, Diego Milito scoring goals. But all of those players, like those guys anchoring Benzema, were creating between 1.2 and 2 chances a game, which is quite a lot for a striker when Mourinho was there. And that's kind of where Kane is this season. And when you look at those teams as well, again, you see a similarity, because Diego Costa, yes, he was scoring goals, but a large part of his job was facilitating Eden Hazard cutting in off the left. Diego Milito was scoring goals, but a large part of his job was facilitating Samuel Eto'o coming in off the left. Benzema facilitating Cristiano Ronaldo. And so now in Kane and Son, he's actually got a really similar setup again, and it works perfectly for what Mourinho wants to do. And as a result, Kane isn't just getting loads of goals and assists, but I was looking at his involvement in build-up play, and he passes into the final third 3.8 times per 90 this season. That's up from a previous best of 2.2. His passes into the box, previous best was 0.7, now it's 1.4. His previous best progressive passes per game was 3, now it's 5. Like, I mean, I know this all just sounds like numbers, 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 he's just doing way, way more progressive passing, way more chance creation, not just creating the final pass, but the pass before that. And it's really interesting to see, like, what this layoff and what a bit of time to focus on what they want to do as a side has enabled them to do. So it's not like I give Mourinho no credit, but I do think that Mourinho, what he's trying to do now would not be possible if it hadn't been for that long layoff.
Yeah, I mean, I liked in the Amazon documentary, one of the things he said to Kane is, you're going to explode under me. I'm going to take you to that next level. And I think, goal scoring aside, I think he's always been an incredible goal scorer. But what you're talking about, his passing and his ability to create for others, it's not like Kane hasn't tried this before. During the World Cup, certainly for England, he used to drop deep and, you know, you'd be pulling your hair out because we just have no one really up in attack. Do you remember? I don't know if you remember against Croatia, the longer that game went on, the deeper he dropped and the more kind of helpless. You know, he obviously won the golden boot there, but I think that hat-trick against Panama really did sort of help him out in that game. But I do think there is something that has to be said for Mourinho, the fact that he has managed to engineer a system where Kane dropping deep is effective. Because I think a lot of the criticism, and you saw him trying to do that last season, where do you remember his shots dramatically dropped off under Mourinho, and his number of his chance creations per game really, really fell down. But now it's all translating into results. It's all translating into assists. And obviously, with Son, he's got an incredible relationship. I sort of feel sorry for Steven Bergvine. I feel like he's really trying to be part of that, but just not quite playing off at the moment. But I think the way that they've managed to create space and they're occupying other defenders in terms of their roaming fullbacks and stuff like that. I do think Mourinho has to take credit for managing to recognise what Kane likes to do in dropping back and creating a system where it actually pays off, as opposed to sort of him trying and trying and trying but not actually having the end product, which is, you know, he's on course to break the assists record this season. I think that would just be another remarkable achievement for Harry Kane.
Yeah, he's not. It wouldn't actually take that much now. But I don't know. I'm intrigued to see them play. It seems weird to say this after they played Man City, but I'm intrigued to see them play an actually good side. I think they've got Chelsea next week, and I'm not sure Chelsea are necessarily good, but I think they're pretty good. I'm interested when they eventually play Liverpool. I think that'll be an exciting one.
Yeah, I mean, you say that about Chelsea. I think that is going to be a fascinating clash, because if you consider. Yeah. I watched the game against Newcastle, and let's not read into that too much. But, you know, N'Golo Conte was as good as I've seen him all season, I think. His ability to, the way that he was breaking down any kind of attack that they put together. And obviously his relationship with Kovacic there. So I think the midfield battle is going to be fascinating in that kind of clash. And then to see whether or not Kane can find the space in between the lines, because it was all too easy sometimes against City this weekend for him to break into that space. He's got such an incredible first touch that he was able to turn around and then look for Son straight away. I think against Conte, that will be a real interesting test of how well he can perform against the toughest. And then also, like I said, in the defence, as we said, City creating a lot of chances, not really going anywhere. Chelsea's attack is running incredibly hot right now, and with Ziyech as well, who's just looks better and better every week. You're right. I think that is going to be a really fascinating clash between two sides who technically kind of play in a similar style and have got similar kind of resources in their banks. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to that one.
Yeah, me too. Well, the last thing I kind of wanted to ask you was, do you think that Spurs can feasibly win the title this year? Because I've got to say, I kind of don't. Like, I think Liverpool would have to... I think Liverpool would just have to implode. I still think City will get their act together. I think, I don't know, man. Like Chelsea and Spurs are kind of hard to decide between. But I don't know. Like I find it hard to imagine. And also because they are running so hot at the moment, I think expected goals suggest their goal difference should be about plus six, which is still very good. But it's like plus 12 right now. I feel like they're running as hot as they possibly could at the moment. Mm. Like, I don't think that there's like an extra gear to be found here. Whereas Liverpool get some people back from injury, they can get better. City find an attacking kind of rhythm and Aguero comes back and they'll be better. With Spurs, I'm like, unless Bale suddenly like rediscovers his prime, I don't see how they get better from here. This is probably as good as they can be. And that's not a knock on them, but it just means that they're not clear now while playing at their best. I think they can get reeled in.
I always find it funny. Sometimes when I see the comments, it always is like, oh, Henry's one of the few people that challenges Pat and stuff like that, which I always find amusing. So, I mean, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit here again, but I mean, you've created this aura where I think people think you're like too scary to sort of disagree with, which maybe is true. Maybe really? Behind my back, you'll go and tell everyone I'm wrong. But I do think that Spurs could challenge for the title. I think it starts really with mentality and the ability to go week by week. And I do think they've shown incredible resilience this season. I mean, let's wipe out that first Everton game where I was thinking, oh God, they're going to be a disaster. If you consider what happened against Newcastle, where they got that handball at the end, and then against West Ham United, where that implosion and that incredible comeback. Those are two scenarios where any other year, I think Spurs would have taken two or three games maybe to rediscover their rhythm and that confidence, sort of get back on the track. But they've always managed to come back and hit the ground running after that. However, where I do agree with you completely, you know, it really does hinge on Harry Kane and his fitness. Gareth Bale, I don't see going to be a 10, 15 goal a season player this season. Unless they play him firmly as a striker and he's not reliant on speed and stuff like that, I think I'm not convinced that he is. I think he's great impact to have. And that also plays into the mentality aspect as well. He's obviously won a ton and contributed to winning those titles. So he should be able to mobilise that squad, which is, you know, I think it's a very close-knit group to the looks of it. But yes, you're right. If a few injuries could really stifle Tottenham season, whereas Liverpool, the addition of Diogo Jota has just been so effective that they've now got another player who looks like he could score, and they've got an interchangeable forward line. And even, you know, Bobby Firmino looked like capable of scoring this weekend, which he hasn't always done, so he could have bagged two or three. So I do think that Tottenham, momentum is a funny thing, football. You only have to think about the Leicester title challenge. I think it's between Chelsea, Liverpool and Tottenham, in my opinion, the title Ooh. Race this season. That's, in my opinion, the three kind of front runners for that. And momentum's a funny thing. So if they can keep this going and if they can keep their players fit, then sure, I really don't see why not. I think they've got some quality additions. Like I said, I love Højbjerg in the midfield. I think defensively, they've got a number of options now. Even Joe Rodon looks like, you know, a tidy addition at the back for the money they paid for him. So yeah, let's just see. I obviously, it's way too early to call. What is it, 9 games in? Something like that. So, yeah. I mean, let's see. Let's revisit this conversation in January. But I don't see why not. They've got enough world-class players in that team to be there or thereabouts, and it just depends on fitness down the line.
Interesting. Well, shall we move on to another title race? Because there was a huge match in the Italian title race this weekend, the hunt for the Scudetto, as AC Milan played Napoli away, and they're now 2 points clear at the top of Serie A after winning 3-1. Pretty impressive stuff. Your other favourite guy, who I hate, Zlatan Ibrahimovic, he scored two. So he joins Lewandowski, Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Erling Haaland as the only players in Europe to have got into double figures so far this season. Mm-hmm. Dries Mertens pulled one back, but Bakayoko got sent off. And at the end, it was new signing AC Milan's Jens-Petter Hauge, who was signed from Bodo Glimt. I'm not really sure on pronunciation there. But he scored a third to make things safe. How do you feel about your boy Zlatan Ibrahimovic at 40 years old succeeding? Because I think everyone thinks I hate him as a footballer because I hate him as a person. But he is absolutely tearing it up this season in Serie A.
I mean, first and foremost, I mean, I was on Continental Club and we previewed this game, a big match preview, and we all got the result wrong. I think we all said Napoli were going to win this. But I mean, on the subject of Ibrahimovic, I mean, I don't know if the first header he scored is just world class.
Yeah, it's outrageous.
From the edge of the box to find that. And I think this is, what I've said recently about him, he's not someone that relies massively on pace, and he's an incredible professional who keeps himself in really good quality and nick. I think that injury he got at Manchester United was maybe the first major one that he'd suffered in a significant while. And I think they've just realised if we can get the ball to this guy in a danger area, he's still got unbelievable ability. He's still got that predator attitude where he can put the ball away. Similar with, you know, Ronaldo. I don't know if you saw his second goal against, was it Cagliari this weekend? But he almost volleyed it behind him. And it's just that kind of innate quality, which I don't think you lose no matter what age you get to. And I was completely on the bandwagon of, what a silly signing. Why spend your money on this guy when they did bring him in? And there's a lot to be said about AC Milan having one of the youngest teams in Europe. But to have a spearhead figure like Ibrahimovic, if he can get them in the Champions League spots, then surely that's a good investment. Surely he's the right person to have around. Because it's all well and good having a young team building towards something, but there's no guarantee that success will follow that. If Ibrahimovic can get them in Champions League spots where they can sign even better younger players, where they can attract even better players to their clubs, then he's surely such a positive and he's a good investment, a short-term investment to have. But yeah, I think I won't read too much into his second goal. That was just good positioning in the box. But yeah, that first goal for me really just defines how confident he is right now. And you know what? Obviously, he tore up the MLS, which I wasn't really sure about. But I think this is one of the most remarkable periods in a pretty stunning career. But I agree with you. Obviously, the personality stuff is a bit jarring. But if we look at the game itself, you know, it was actually pretty even. It was 1.9 to 1.8, according to XG. And Napoli managed 20 shots with 10 men. I mean, that Bakayoko challenge on a yellow card was ludicrous. Yeah. I don't know who... it was just outrageous that he'd even consider going in for that. The other interesting thing I was considering recently is whether or not Sweden would consider him going in for their Euro squad this summer. I mean, there's no reason why he wouldn't get into that team. I think it's a choice between him and maybe Marcus Berg. But so that's a kind of interesting thing to revisit down the line. I think even on Twitter, he sort of teased the idea. But yeah, I think that first goal, like I said, was just a real hallmark of just a legacy title in terms of Ibrahimovic as a whole.
Yeah, I don't really mind the age thing like so much with Ibrahimovic because the rest of the Milan squad is young. Like, my issue with like spending money on older players is firstly if you pay a transfer fee, which they didn't, and secondly if you then end up with a team which is, you know, super reliant on them. And I mean, in some ways Milan are, like, he's obviously getting a load of goals, but they've got a bunch of other guys developing, and if Ibrahimovic tides them over until Rafael Leao really breaks out, or if they get Brahim Diaz on a permanent or whoever it might be, then I think they'll be in a great position. And I think they're probably shocked to be flying to this degree this season. Like, I think they'd have definitely, if you offered them fourth place before the season started, I think they'd have definitely taken it. It looks like a title's possible. I mean, like, I can understand why you guys backed Napoli for this match before the weekend, because Napoli have also been great. Inter have been great, but Atalanta are in pretty poor form. Juventus are one of the three unbeaten sides left in the league, along with Sassuolo and AC Milan, but they've got 4 wins, 4 draws in 8, I think. So, I don't know. There's not really an outstanding side. In fact, Roma have the best expected points in the league. Roma have, I think, the best attack in the league. And yet just somehow aren't putting the results together quite as you'd like at the moment, though Henrik Mkhitaryan is having an absolute season for the ages. So I don't know. I think that I'm not sure that I'd back them to sneak a title, but I wouldn't be totally shocked if it happened now. And I think it would be totally fair to say that would be one of the greatest achievements of Zlatan's career in terms of overachieving. I don't think he's never really won a title in a country where he wasn't on the best side. This would be the first time he's done that, and he'd be doing it at nearly 40 years old, which is pretty amazing. I just want him to knock off all the stuff like Zlatan didn't get coronavirus, COVID got Zlatan, or whatever the shut up, you bellend. Like, every time he says something like that, it makes me want to slap his stupid face. But
I just assume there's some new people discovering Zlatan who sort of buy into that, and
yeah,
that
15 year olds who think that's cool.
So stupid.
All right, well, I think we've got time for one more topic, so I'm going to offer you a choice of things to discuss. Okay, there's Pep's new contract and the possibility of going after Leo Messi. There's Nicolas Pepe's headbutt against Leeds and whether there's a path back for him at Arsenal. And finally, there's Atletico Madrid and Barcelona, who, of course, played each other on Saturday.
You know what? I think we should go for Pepe's headbutt. The Atletico-Barcelona game, I don't think there's anything particularly shocking there. A 1-0 victory.
Yannick, I mean, Ter Stegen coming out, though, was pretty shocking. That was amazing.
It was very poor. But I will say that Longley should have definitely have scored one of his headers and chances there. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's a pretty classic Atletico victory, that, isn't it? It's a dogged 1-0 display. But yeah, I mean, look, Barcelona, we've talked about them a number of times across all of our platforms, in a bit of a free-for-all at the moment. The same cannot be said for Atletico, who, in my opinion, the conditions are ripe for Atletico title challenge. I said that at the start of the season, and I don't see why. This game only goes to prove that more. If Barcelona manage to recover from this point, then I'll be shocked. But I think the Pepe situation is more fascinating, because the amount of money that was spent on him, this is going to be an interesting reference point for Arsenal's transfers going forwards. And I remember, when they were trying to get Houssem Aouar in the summer, and the president of Lyon, Jean-Michel Aulas, saying, well, if they're going to spend 72 million on Pepe, they can spend more money on Aulas and on Aouar than 45 million. And that headbutt is unforgivable. It is unforgivable. And you saw how angry Arteta was. And in my opinion, I haven't seen enough from Pepe as an all-round performer. He has to have some flashy moments. He has scored some nice goals. I always remember his opening, one of his first games he played for Arsenal against Liverpool, where he almost scored an incredible goal. He sort of burst through. I can't remember if it was a save or he hit the post, but he almost got off to an incredible start, and it could have laid the foundations for him to build upon that. I don't know if you remember what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but where he skinned Robertson on the counter.
Yeah, and then it's just since then, it's just he's never quite taken off on a consistent period. And it's getting to the point now where Arteta's going to need to pick his best 11. He hasn't got any room for passengers. Obviously, Pepe came out recently saying he's a happier man when he's playing football. He deserves time to play. And then he goes and does what he did on the field there. And he's just given Arteta a reason to bench him for three games or so or something like that and just say, you're not getting back in this team until something changes. But I mean, as an Arsenal fan, how frustrating was that to see your record signing, who hasn't really performed like a record signing, let's face it, go ahead and do something like that?
I just turned the game off. I was just like, I didn't expect us to win. In fact, I expected us to lose, but I'm not going to enjoy watching the rest of this game. Like, we're obviously going to have to sit really deep and try and counter. And to be honest, later on, like, I was told, and then I watched some highlights, that Bukayo Saka was very good when he came on. So that's good. That's fine. I mean, for him to do that, I think the only excuse would be if something seriously extreme was said, which nobody is saying. You know, like, if somebody says something like racist to you, then sure. Obviously, like, is it better for the club that you walk off the pitch? Yeah, but I'm not going to tell people how to respond to that. But if someone's just being a dick to you and you go and headbutt them, you know what's going to happen. Like, it's just so stupid. And actually, Arsenal weren't great in this game. But I actually felt like Pepe had some good moments in the first half. And it was quite nicely set up for him. Because if there's one thing he's good at, it's like taking his man on one-on-one. And against Leeds, you're going to get to do that because Leeds man mark across the whole field. So I was like, this is a game quite nicely set up for you. There were a couple of times in the first half he managed to wriggle away from his marker, you know, like both in his own half and in the attacking third, and either, you know, like help build a counter-attack or he got a shot off. Like, it's, and so it was just like, it was just kind of disappointing. And the thing is, you know, I don't think he's been great. I don't think that he's, I mean, to be honest, I don't really rate him at all. but I think he's fine. Like, I think there are other players in the league who people think are really good wingers who are not really better than Pepe. And it's clear he's a real confidence player. Like, when he's confident, he can do like some pretty remarkable stuff. Mm. And he's certainly not a bad player, but he's an idiot for this at least. And he just doesn't fit clearly with what Arteta wants. So I don't know. He's been stuck in this role that doesn't suit him. So I think there's some, I give him some leeway there, you know, and the fact that Aubameyang's looked bad as well. Like basically all of Arsenal's attackers have looked bad. I think that has to come down to Arteta rather than individual attackers. But yeah, now Arsenal are going to have another few weeks where they play, well, they'll play Saka and that's okay, but they're also going to have to play either Nelson or Willian, and it's just like really demoralising. Or they'll go back to playing Aubameyang on the wing. I mean, really, my feeling is kind of, my feeling's been the same like over the last few weeks, which is I actually am just really looking forward to Martinelli coming back, because Martinelli, I think, is kind of, he's not really an on the ball player. Like, he's a guy who's like, who makes run. He's really a striker playing on the wing, but he's a good, but he's a good dribbler. He's unbelievably fast. His intensity is genuinely incredible. And I think that's true of the youth players generally, you know, like Nelson, Willock, Saka, Martinelli, like these guys work so much harder than Aubameyang or Pepe or whoever it might be. And so now I'm just kind of like, this season is not going anywhere. You might as well give your youngsters as many minutes as possible. Like, you might as well play Saliba every week. Like, he can't be that much worse. Like, I don't know. I just think, like, Arsenal should probably take advantage of the fact that they've got nothing to play for, really, by getting as many minutes as possible for their youngsters, because you can see the effect it's had on Saka. So, I don't know. I don't really have a coherent answer, but there's a part of me that's just like, his value's the lowest now it'll ever be, unless Arteta finds a way to use him as more of an inside forward than a winger, and gives him his confidence back. But there's a part of me that's like, Arteta's never going to like Pepe. He's never going to like him. Like, yeah, do we just cut our losses here? Yeah, I don't know. I just think like Pepe's never going to be that kind of guy for Arteta. Arteta wants him to track back, and he actually did track back quite a bit in this game. I don't know why people are saying he didn't. But he's never going to be that hardworking defensively. He's never going to want to stick on the sideline, which seems to be what Arteta wants him to do. You know, like, he plays really far out, and it's actually Bellerin who comes inside rather than the other way around. And where Pepe had success at Lille was as basically an inside forward, almost as a second striker at times. I just think that those things are never really going to chime under Arteta. And so, yeah, if Arteta leaves, then maybe you can get another manager in who would get more out of Pepe, but
you're already floating the possibility of Arteta leaving. You already think that's a kind of theoretical scenario that the Arsenal board would entertain.
I don't know. I don't think the Arsenal board would do it, but it depends where we are. Like, I mean, if say by next summer there are no signs of progress at all, I would be thinking seriously about doing it. Like, I don't want to do it now because it's still been under a year, and like, you know, there's been two pretty bad transfer windows since he took over. But yeah, like, obviously there are holes in the squad, and that's partially his fault, but it's not entirely his fault. But it depends whether we've improved in other ways. Like, I think the defense has improved and some of the passing out from the back. But when he arrived, he was like, I want us to play on the front foot. I want us to press all the time. Arsenal are one of the least aggressive pressing sides in the league. Like, genuinely, I think we're second bottom. Like, we press so little. And when we do press, it's really defensive. It's to, like, try and get them to play the ball back to their keeper rather than to try and win the ball high and create chances, which is how a team like Southampton gets around the fact that they don't have an attacking midfielder. They use a high press to generate good chances. We don't do that at all. Like, we don't press. Sure. Like, he says he wants people to press, but he doesn't really. He wants people to track back, like, because people aren't pressing. So unless we start to see some positives in those senses, like, I'm not saying we have to be a good side. We don't have to be a top four side. But if by the end of the season, he's been in charge for what, 18 months, and there aren't clear signs of progress and clear signs that we're adapting to his style, then you would say, like, what are we expecting to happen if we keep you on? Like, are you telling us that we make like two signings next summer and everything's suddenly amazing? Maybe that's true. Maybe it's like Spurs were a kind of mid-table side last year. They made a couple of good signings, they slightly changed their system around, and like, now everything looks better. But maybe that's not the case, and then I think that you have to at least think about changing the manager if people like Pochettino are out there available, if guys like Hasenhüttl us at Southampton if Thomas Tuchel has been sat by PSG. Yeah. But I don't want him to be fired. I want him to have the time. It's just that obviously it depends what he shows. Like, he needs to show something this season. And if he just says, you know, like this game, he really changed the system up. He was like, right, we're going to play 4-3-3. And you look at it and you're like, God, Xhaka shouldn't be playing. Like, I don't think Willock should be playing. I wouldn't want Willian playing. So if say by the end of this, if say they go out in January and they buy like an attacking midfielder, and then next summer they're like in for a winger, and suddenly you're like, okay, you've got Saka on one wing, you've got Martinelli or another winger on the other, Aubameyang through the middle, and then you've got a midfield two of like Sabai or some party behind like an attacking midfielder, and everything's working, then I'll start to see it. But if we don't do that and we continue doing this thing of let's sign some old players and let's not press and let's not take shots and all this kind of stuff, then I just think where is the hope for the future?
Can I just ask you, because you touched upon their summer transfer windows there. On reflection, because I feel pretty strongly about this one way, if you had that 48, 45 million, whatever it was you paid for Thomas Partey, and you had the choice of Houssem Aouar, considering Arsenal haven't scored now for, what is it, 4 or 5 games on the bounce?
Yeah, like nearly 8 hours.
Really? I mean,
from open play.
If you could have gone in and bought, because I read somewhere in some gossip columns that apparently Arteta and Edu were differing. One of them wanted Partey, one of them wanted Aouar, and I think and they ended up going for Partey, obviously. If you could revisit that scenario, would you choose Aouar? Do you think he would have been, in terms of what Arsenal need right now, if you consider they've got Xhaka, they've got Elneny, who, I mean, look, I'm not saying he's a world beater, but obviously Arteta trusts him and likes him. And then they've got Dani Ceballos as well, who obviously played in that holding role with Xhaka this week. But creative in front of them, that's kind of where they're lacking right now with this reluctance to use Mesut Ozil at all. So if you could revisit that, would you go in for the Leon man instead of Partey? Who, you know, I personally have always... I know you love Thomas Partey, and we've talked about him a lot on previous podcasts. But in my opinion, he might not necessarily be the dynamic change that they fundamentally needed to kick on that midfield.
Well, there are a few things to say up front. I mean, firstly, we haven't actually seen Partey play that much. Mm. And if Arteta now sticks with this 4-3-3 and puts Partey in instead of Xhaka, which allows kind of the attacking players to stay a bit higher and be a bit more aggressive, then it might be that that does have an attacking benefit, you know? Like, it might be that then Arsenal do start creating more because they're a bit more solid further back. I think that's totally possible. At the time, I was definitely on the Aouar rather than Partey wagon, mostly because he's younger. Because equally, you know, like, maybe if we'd signed Aouar, like, maybe our defence is in a much worse position now than it has been. And we're saying, well, Arsenal should have gone and got a guy who could do more defensive work in midfield. And there's also the fact that Aouar is not that creative. Like, he isn't. Like, he's not someone who's put up like lots of key passes at any point in his career. He's a great dribbler, and he's getting lots of shots this season. And your hope is that his dribbling pulls teams around, makes more space for the other attackers, and that gives you more creativity. But you're actually making an argument kind of similar to Partey. You're saying, we hope that by putting this guy in with these special abilities, it will create more space for other people to do creative stuff. You're not saying Aouar's going to come in and get like create three chances a game, because he's never done that, ever. Like, he's never even got close to that. He's like an under half that number of key passes per game guy. So I think he's at like 1 this season, if that. So yes, I think that I would have gone for Aouar because of the money, because I think he would have also given them some of the press resistance Partey gives. And because I think our problem towards the end of last season was driving the ball forward more than it was defensive. And I do think that Aouar is better at Partey when it comes to doing that in the final third rather than the midfield third. But to be honest with you, I'm not sure I'd have gone for either. I think if I had 50 mil available in the summer, I think I probably would have gone and got 2 good young players in both of those positions rather than one player who I thought was going to be a superstar in one of those positions. Like, I'm not complaining about a signing Partey. I wouldn't have complained about a signing Aouar at all. But I think that if I were Arsenal, I'd have said, you know what, we can get like Dominic Szoboszlai for like 25 million euros. I'm sure we can get like a defensive slash central midfielder for 25 to 30 million. You know, why are we not doing that rather than dumping all this money on one player when we clearly have so many holes in the squad? So yes, I agree with you. Aouar would have been the smarter choice, but I think there would have been even smarter choices than that available. And my worry is with that as well, that, you know, Arsenal have said now, Arteta's manager. He's not head coach, he's manager. And that means he's going to get more of a say in transfers. And I think that our transfer business since he arrived has been terrible. You know, Cedric, Pablo Marie, those are bad signings.
Yeah, it's bad signing.
Like, Willian is genuinely such an appalling signing. I don't think that people understood at the time because we didn't pay any money. And Partey, great player. But it remains to be seen how good a signing it is, because it remains to be seen how much it improves the team. So,
it is funny how Willian performing well against Fulham on the opening day has created this idea that it was good. And on reflection, it was, Jesus. You know, if he didn't perform well against Fulham, then there would be more questions asked, I think, than that. No, I agree with you. It's an interesting time for Arteta moving forward. And I like Arsenal. You know, I've always sort of been invested in them. I'd lived in North London for a long time near the stadium. And, you know, I was genuinely quite excited when he won the FA Cup, when it looked like they were going somewhere. But it is, there just does seem to be something just not quite clicking when it comes to the whole kind of cohesion of the club behind the scenes and stuff like that. To get the right players on the pitch. Obviously, hindsight is a wonderful thing, especially in football more than anything. But yeah, it is intriguing to see, to hear a fan like yourself, maybe, who, you know, one day could have been loving Arteta. Now, you know, it's interesting to see how that kind of fluctuates and changes with all the results that are coming in.
Yeah, well, I mean, I kind of weirdly get Instagram messages from people saying, like, why are you so biased towards Arteta? Why are you so anti-Lampard? It's like, I feel like I've never, ever, like, I've never said, like, unequivocally that I think Arteta is amazing. I just think that there are reasons to be positive about him. And I think those reasons still exist. But I think it was interesting that he said before the international break, oh, well, you know, after a loss like this Villa one, you know, the temptation is to go and change everything and you don't want to do that. And then it felt like he did change like an awful lot of stuff. I kind of think he needs to do that. Like, I think he needs to say, when we sit deep, we're not particularly effective defensively and we create absolutely nothing in attack. So why are we doing it? Like, why are we doing it? Why don't we play like pound shop? Why don't we play like Liverpool did in Klopp's first season, where the squad was still all over the place, there was loads of talent missing, but they had a really clear style and it worked for them. Like, why are we not playing like even like Southampton? Like, let's find a way to get around our personnel issues. And I feel like he's been so scared of like what will happen if he opens up to the defence that he has just said with the attack, oh, well, Aubameyang's a great player. I'm sure he'll carry on scoring goals. Well, he's in his 30s now and he can't score goals out of nowhere. I mean, maybe that's the one positive from this game, actually. Having averaged, I think, like 1.2 shots a game over the first 8 weeks of the season, Aubameyang got 3 shots in this match. And they weren't great shots. They weren't like big chances. But even in easier games against terrible opposition, he hasn't been getting 3 shots a game. So the fact that he was able to do that in this match, despite Arsenal going down to 10 men, I'd say is a tiny, tiny, tiny positive.
No, it's good. I mean, yeah, I don't have much more to add to that. I think, you know, it's nice to hear. I'm sure the viewers will enjoy a sort of classic Pato Arsenal let loose, as it were. But yeah, I mean, Arsenal... I really did think they were going to kick on this season. I really did think they'd be up there competing with the likes, you know, the top four. But the way the league's going, with Leicester running hot at the moment as well, City falling, United just really sort of struggling to put together a consistent kind of period of good fortunes. Yeah, I mean, there's always seemed to be a fall guy from one of the big teams. And, I, you know, fingers crossed it's not, but it could be Arsenal this season.
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting to find out, I guess. Interesting. I think that's all we've got time for today, Henry. Is there anything that you'd like to give a plug to before we leave?
Goodness. Keep checking out our FD Explained and EFD Explained new segments that we're putting out. You know, a lot of thought and time goes into those, and a bit more dynamic than perhaps our listicles. So hopefully you enjoy those and appreciate that. And obviously, like, I think I need to tip my hat to like some of our editors, Danny and the guys behind the scenes, who are really good at putting together some pretty neat stuff at the moment in terms of getting footage out there. So hopefully you guys enjoy that a bit more.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you very much for being on the show today, Henry. And thank you to you guys for watching or listening at home. If you subscribe to the podcast as an audio podcast, please also subscribe to Football Daily Podcast on YouTube. If you watch on YouTube, maybe seek us out on a podcast app and then you can check us out on your commute or whatever it might be once we finally get out of this lockdown. Thanks to you all very much, and we will see you next time. Bye.